space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Penske Podcast, which is a Star Trek themed podcast, and we made it to the movies. We're here to talk about Star Trek, the motion picture. I'm joined by Clay. Clay, how are you?
I'm good. I feel like this is right in my sweet spot of Star Trek love, I think, in my own mind, because it's the OG crew with the Next Generation music.
They covered all the bases. Yeah, it's... I think we're going to have a lot of stuff to talk about that with the motion picture. But if you guys are
also, you should get real high before we talk about this or before you watch this movie, because it will help.
I think that if you guys haven't tuned into the podcast before, this is a Star Trek podcast where we're going through all the episodes of all the series and everything. We've done TOS and TNG. We just wrapped up TOS, and now we're moving on to the motion picture. We're going to be doing all the movies. You guys can check out the PenskePodcast.com. If you want a audio feed, you can find us on iTunes and all that stuff. Just saying that for people who have not tuned in and found us somehow stumbling onto YouTube or something like that. But we're going to be talking about the motion picture, which was directed by Robert Wise, produced by Gene Roddenberry. Screenplay goes to Harold Livingston, and it was released on December 7th,
1979. How long since it had been off the air? About 10 years.
Ten
almost,
years,
right?
Yep, okay, 10 years. Right, so, in this movie, a mysterious and immensely powerful alien clan known as V'ger approaches Earth, destroying everything in its path. Admiral James T. Kirk resumes command of his previous starship, the recently refitted USS Enterprise, to lead it on a mission to save the planet and determine V'ger's origins. We're going to play an audio clip. Me and Clay are going to come back, and we're going to break down the very first Star Trek movie. It's Star Trek: The Motion Picture.
Let's talk.
Sure. Let me know when that backup's ready.
Aye, sir.
All due respect, sir, I hope this isn't some kind of Starfleet pep talk. I'm really too busy.
I'm taking over the Zeta seat, Will.
You're what?
I'm replacing you as captain of the Enterprise. You'll stay on as executive officer. A temporary grade reduction to commander.
You personally are assuming command?
Yeah.
May I ask why?
My experience. 5 years out there dealing with unknowns like this. My familiarity with the Enterprise, its crew.
Admiral, this is an almost totally new Enterprise. You don't know her a tenth as well as I do.
That's why you're staying aboard. I'm sorry, Will.
No, Admiral. I don't think you're sorry.
Not one damn bit.
I remember when you recommended me for this command. You told me how envious you were and how much you hoped you'd find a way to get a starship command again. Well, sir, it looks like you found a way.
Report to the bridge, Commander. Immediately.
Aye, sir.
So, Clay, as you mentioned before we went to break, it's been 10 years. If it's 1979, it's been 10 years since Star Trek aired its last episode of a TV series, which was back in 1969, obviously. And, you know, watching the TOS series all the way through changed my opinion or my appreciation for this movie. Did you feel anything different just from having watched a couple of the episodes leading up to this?
Yes and no. You know, the thing that has always stood out to me about this movie is how I don't know why they went and took Star Trek, which is like primarily very brightly colored and, you know, red, blue, and yellow everywhere, really pops off the screen. And they said, you know what? That's just too old-fashioned. Let's make everything like gray and taupe.
Yep. Stainless steel, too. There's a lot of stainless steel.
And, you know, I could never figure out why. And watching the old episodes again, it really stood out. It's like, it's such a, there's, I almost don't feel like, I don't know if this is a case of just, you know, people looking at different as they get older or whatnot, but I've always felt there's a big disconnect between the original series, the actual show, and the movies themselves.
Right.
Because the style is so different. And even in this one, you know, I'm sure we'll get into this a lot, but one of the things that's really fascinating to me about this movie is how it doesn't give you a lot of the stuff that you like about Star Trek.
Right.
I mean, I guess that's it's debatable depending on what you like about Star Trek. But I mean, the thing that I was thinking that having watched the old episodes and really kind of seen how the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy dynamic work in the show, that's non-existent in this movie.
Yeah. Yep.
Like just character in general. There's nothing. There's like some good ideas and some stuff that could have been nice character arcs, but they either wrap them up super quickly or whatever they are just completely inconsequential.
I think that's a good way to break it, to break into the sort of fact stuff about this. I'm not going to go too heavy on this because I don't think people really care, but I do think it's interesting to just sort of understand that this was obviously a troubled production that went through a lot of scripts. It started with Roddenberry trying to produce something and convince Paramount to come up with a movie after the series ended. They said, okay, do something. He came up with the idea of an alien spaceship that comes back to Earth and wants to destroy humanity. They said, we'll try to do this. They couldn't get it to work, so they said, you know what, fuck it. We're going to not do it as a movie. Let's make another TV series out of this. Mm-hmm. And so they made Phase 2. And the pilot of Phase 2 was basically the same idea about an alien probe that comes back to Earth and tries to kill everybody. They seemed to like this idea, or Roddenberry seemed to love this idea. And then they said, you know what, Phase 2, cancel that. We're actually going to make a movie. A lot of sci-fi movies and a lot of fantasy stuff is coming out. We need to make a Star Trek movie.
Yeah, Star Wars had just hit.
Yep,
so Star Wars needed something, as Walter Koenig says in the interview on the DVD, one of the guys at Paramount probably said, so what do we have that's like Star Wars?
And so they came out with Star Trek the Motion Picture that was basically being produced until like the day before it was due to be released. So it was a awesome rush to get this out. It was being rewritten on set. Roddenberry had a big impact and everything like that. And the funny thing, going into it before this rewatch, right, I remembered the motion picture basically just being a super boring, long movie.
Mm-hmm.
And
I don't think
my opinion of that has changed at all.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that the first 40 minutes are really fascinating. And
that's a good word to use.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is, going off your point, this is nothing like the original series, what this movie is doing. This movie is like angry and dark.
Mm-hmm.
And Kirk is basically an asshole for the first 40 minutes, right? McCoy says that he somehow forced Starfleet's hand to give him back the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
He kicks out this seemingly nice guy, Decker, to be his subordinate and take
child
his place.
Child molester.
And then all the interactions are basically the other characters just saying, like, telling Kirk that, you know, time has passed him by and it's not his ship anymore. And he says, mm-hmm. you know what, I'm going to do this anyway. And then they just abandon all that. And none of it really matters and none of it pans out and none of it means anything in the end. But it's a really interesting way to, like, imagine if you were, I just did a lot of imagining what if I was a fan who had waited 10 years and this came out.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would have been really disappointed at first. Although I don't know if I'd appreciate the movie more after I thought about it for a little bit.
Yeah. What you described about Kirk, they do to everybody. I mean, Spock has the same sort of thing where he's got this Spock's, I don't even want to call it an arc, but basically Spock returns to the Enterprise even less emotional than he was on the show because he's been training for the
Kolinar.
I don't know if you train for that or if you just do it.
he's like halfway there. He didn't quite complete the test, but he sort of took all the studies, I guess, would be the way to describe it.
Yeah, and he's on there. He comes back to the Enterprise because he believes that, and this is what he says, this is all you get, that whatever this thing is will provide him with answers. But we never figure out what the questions are.
Right.
You know? Like it took me a while to figure out what the hell he was even doing there. Like what? And then, you know, he has his little bit where he goes moonwalking and right up into the butthole of the alien, and which I have to admit was a really awesome sequence. That whole thing was really cool. But, you know, then he tries to mind meld with a giant fucking space robot.
Yep.
And it almost kills him. And then after that, he's like, oh, right, love or something.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And then that's just it. That's the end of Spock's story. And it's not like there's no you don't even realize that anything happened, kind of.
Right.
Because you don't know what the stakes are for anything in this movie.
I think what you mentioned before about the characters is really important. There's no interaction between any character in this movie that feels like it was born of the series. In fact, the whole movie to me feels like something catastrophic happened 2 years before this movie took place to the crew.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Because everyone comes in pissed off. Like, why is Spock so, like, dismissive of the crew when he returns? Is that supposed to be that we're supposed to understand that the Kolinar has made him even less attached to the crew?
I think so, yeah. I think that's, and I mean, on the surface as an idea, I like the idea. Like, if you're pitching me this movie and you say, so, you know, it's 10 years later, Kirk wants to get the
It's only 2 years in terms of the
oh, really?
Universe.
Oh, well, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's later. Kirk's an admiral now, but he really wants his ship back. And his desire to still be relevant makes him disrespect the actual captain of the Enterprise and cause problems because he doesn't know how things work anymore. And on top of that, Spock comes back to the Enterprise and he's trying to rid himself of all emotion, so he's even colder. So, like, there's a rift between the relationship.
Right.
But then, obviously, you would think through the action of the movie, at least somehow
they would get their groove back.
Yeah, thematically, if not explicitly, Kirk and Spock would remember, you know, get back to the way that they were or something like that. There would be, you know, but there's just none of that.
No, there isn't. No.
Yeah. It's basically, you know, they give you those setups and then they kind of blow it off halfway through the movie. And then the rest of it is just sort of like close-ups of people staring out the viewfinder.
Yeah. I mean, would you agree that to me, this movie is three very distinct segments. It's the first 40 minutes up until they leave the dry dock. That's that's the movie that I consider to be the most interesting. Then it's about an hour and a half of flying to V'ger, basically.
Yeah.
And then the last 10 minutes just kind of wraps up the movie. Like, those are the breakdowns of it. And I've said that the movie feels long. The movie is only like 2 hours and 10 minutes, which is kind of long for a movie. But it feels long because there's not really anything happening for 75% of the movie.
Right.
They're just finding V'ger. And I will say that one of the most impressive things the movie does is that it's probably the most effective example of demonstrating scale of something that I think I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, they do a good job.
V'ger seems huge. V'ger is like annoying. They do it by making you fly past it for an hour and a half and you're still flying past it, but it comes across as very, very impressively big.
Yeah, the effects in this movie are actually really great. I mean, they got every penny they put into the model budget or the effects budget is on the screen. That's why, you know, Douglas Trumbull, the guy who is behind everything, gets the first credit when the movie's over.
Right.
yeah, they do. I mean, V'ger is like, I don't think it really gets enough credit for how awesome it actually is.
Yeah.
Because it's somehow abstract, but you can also get the feeling of scale. But there's also like a weird, almost supernatural component to it when Spock goes into the middle of it. And it's a creature unlike anything I've seen in a sci-fi movie, even up to this point.
Yeah.
At least in the way that they illustrate it.
I mean, you never know if you're making progress towards anything when they're flying past it. It's all just very sort of random stuff. And I mean, it culminates in you actually, the center of it is the Voyager probe, which is hilarious. And also like it's fitting.
Yeah, that was kind of silly. I mean, it's silly. It's not silly in concept. I actually like the concept. It's kind of cool. But, like, when they get there and it's literally just, like, bolted into the ground with four screws. It's been there for like 300 years, and all the only thing holding it there is like a hexagon bolt.
It's the most impressive thing is just how much they've built up around it. I guess this alien race is just really impressive. But I do want to sort of focus this because I think the movies, and we'll start here. So I want to go in kind of like an order, not plot beat, but by like segment, I guess. The movies, it's nice to be watching the movies because when we talk about the episodes, right, the shows always have a very workmanlike look to them, right? Because it's a TV show. They need 26 of these. There's no time for like flair in how the things look. It's just film the episode, film the script that we've got. And so a lot of our episode breakdowns are usually about the story, right? Because it's the only thing that changes day to day. The movies are interesting because they're flipping everything around on us, and they're actually, if this is Roddenberry's true vision of what he thought Star Trek would be, that's fascinating. So I want to start at the start. Why would you, if you were watching this after having watched three seasons of the series, would you have been happy with the amount of refitting that the Enterprise went under? I feel they went too far with how much they changed the ship, basically. And
I personally, as far as the outside of the ship goes, I think it's a huge improvement.
The outside is, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the outside is a much better design, and it seems a lot less like they made it out of, you know, like foam core and popsicle sticks.
Yeah.
But they don't. They still retain the iconic look of it. Inside, yeah. I mean, I guess you're more apt to answer that than I am, because I never really paid attention to the bridge that much in the like the positions are still there, you know. Captain's in the same place. Sulu and Chekov, well, Chekov kind of moved, but because they needed to put the ball chick there.
But what if so how about, like, you're probably more familiar with TNG, right? So what if in Generations we opened on Generations with the bridge from the Enterprise E, which is the first contact bridge, like the next Enterprise bridge.
Yeah.
Would you have been like, what happened to the D bridge? Like, what happened to the ship? You know what I mean?
What happened to the D and D? No. honestly, no, I don't think I would have minded.
You wouldn't have minded?
Because I would expect them to upgrade stuff for a movie.
Okay.
You know, that makes sense to me that they would do it. I don't know if necessarily, I mean, like, just practically, if you shot the existing television set, it would look terrible.
Oh, it would look terrible, yeah.
But I don't know if they needed to go so far as to add those weird, like, snap-on commands high chair seats onto the seats, but
that would be my point, is that I would have kept the design of the original and upgraded it. Like, I feel they changed it a little bit too much. Like, it's as you say, it looks like similar, it's the same style idea, but I feel like it doesn't feel like I'm on the bridge of the Enterprise. And I think it ties into the movie doesn't feel like the show at all. And
I think that's fair.
Yeah, and a lot of it's because they're in a weird environment and the characters aren't acting like the characters. And it's not that I want a 2-hour-long version of a TOS episode, because that would kill me inside, I think. I don't think I'd be able to actually watch it all the way through. the podcast would just be a lie about me pretending that I've watched it. But
you could probably ballpark it and get it right.
I think that the opening to me after watching the first three seasons makes me appreciate why they did the things they did. And I understand that, you know, the tour of the Enterprise where Scotty and Kirk fly around it takes way too long, and they definitely didn't need to fly past it then come back again looking at it again.
One of the things I was going to ask you, actually, was, do you feel like that is, because I was trying to think about this, because I know that's like the, I'm sorry to hijack your point, but that specific scene where they do the flyby, do you think that's warranted? Because part of me, I know that that's the scene that everybody kind of jokes on, but part of me kind of understands it. It is definitely long-winded, but I can see why, going from TV to movie, they've upgraded the design of the ship, they're really trying to show everything off. I can see why they'd want to you know, really give it a grand unveiling.
No, that's, I totally agree. I think that if you had waited 10 years after watching this as a TV series, seeing the flyby of a ship, you've never seen this angle of the ship before on the TV show. You know what I mean? It gives you a sense of how big the ship actually is, which you've never seen before. And I appreciate it. Just goes on way too long. It's basically 2 minutes too long. But other than that, it's like really, it's nice. And, you know, you get to see that. The one thing that they did do is that they made it clear that Kirk thrives in this position. And it's unclear why he would ever agree to leave. But the show was always very clear that Kirk's number one love is the Enterprise. And I think that kind of long pan shot of the Enterprise fits the character and everything like that. And I think that really works.
Yeah, I think so too. I've been under the impression that like he was forcibly promoted or something like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah. It's against, obviously not something he was interested in doing.
Yeah. You know, if talking about the look of everything, I think part of why it doesn't feel like Star Trek, and really on top of the colors and the redesign, is they shoot the bridge differently.
Yes.
I as far as I can remember, really, you only kind of get one or two angles of the bridge in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely shoot from a few different angles in the movie. And so that plus, yeah, shifting some stuff around a little bit, it kind of makes it feel a little bit unfamiliar. And as for the color stuff,
the bridge thing, I think, is that in the motion picture, I don't get the sense that the captain's chair is the center of the bridge.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Did you all, this is a side thing. Did you notice that for some reason the headrests move up and down by themselves?
Does it sense when you're entering a rocky space or something? It just accommodates your...
There's a couple times, like during turbulence or something, where if you can see the headsets like sliding up behind them. I'm not sure why it happens.
what did you want to say about the colors and everything? Because I think it's interesting.
It's like the movie is beautifully drab.
Yes.
I used to hate it. I used to think to myself, God, why? And I still do think this to an extent. Why did they take the show that is known primarily for its, or one of its big identifying things is its bold use of color, and just make it so bland looking.
I mean, the poster is a rainbow.
Yeah, the poster is unbelievable. The poster, I mean, you know, painted by the great Bob Peake, who's one of the great poster artists that ever lived. But it's an unbelievable image. And you know, as I'm watching it, I'm still thinking that, but it's occurring to me, I'm looking at it and going, you know, these colors aren't amazing, they don't pop, but this, it's a beautiful movie. It is like the palette they chose for this movie is so perfectly balanced that any frame you stop and get a screenshot of looks like a 70s sci-fi painting.
Right.
And I really appreciate that, because I think I've said this in the past before, where I wish that kind of old style, you know, pulp sci-fi cover art, someone would use that as like the basis for a sci-fi film that's made now, because everything just looks the same now. It would be cool to go back and make something based off that more different kind of color, weird color stuff. But they kind of get some of that in this, because all of the matte paintings in this movie, which are awesome, are also like weird. I think it's because there's a certain kind of paint that you have to use when you do these matte paintings, and they photograph kind of weird. So everything is – all the matte paintings have sort of like weird reds and weird greens and stuff. And it feels like those sci-fi book covers.
Right.
But yeah, even when you get past that stuff to the stuff when you get into the ship, and you've got these grays and these like taupes and these kind of blues that are in there.
Yeah,
and it's just a really beautifully shot movie, but it's just really – just really drab looking. Like, and I don't – I'm trying to say that in the least offensive way possible. Like it's – it's a gorgeous movie, but it's just like,
well,
it's like a blandly gorgeous movie.
Yeah, they went with like everything is like cream colored. Like would be a way to sort of it's everything is kind of just a little bit like everything's a little bit drabber than you expect it to be, and it's uniformly designed to be that way because every shot is that way.
I will say, however, when they do hit you with some different colored lights, like you know, you'll get some green lights and some red lights that are kind of reminiscent of the show.
Yeah,
they do work. They do definitely pop.
Yeah, V'ger at the end is all red.
Oh, yeah, V'ger's. Yeah. I don't know. We could talk about that this part later, but I just love that they have, like, travel jackets that they wear.
It's like South Park, Ike's traveling suit when Ike has to go anywhere.
Now that I say that, it reminds me of The Cage. Because The Cage had the same thing, where The Cage was, like, very brown, and they hadn't worked, I don't think they didn't work the reds in, and they hadn't really worked a lot of the blues in. It was kind of like browns and yellows. And even when they go down to the planet, they have those weird, like, away team jackets that they wore.
Yep.
And it's the same kind of difference between, I mean, this is a better looking movie than The Cage is a show.
Right.
But it's just an interesting, it's an interesting way to go. I don't know why they decided to do it.
My
theory is that they basically said, because this whole movie feels, after you get past the fact that it's the Enterprise versus the Windows Media Player, the whole movie is basically the look and feel of 2001 A Space Odyssey,
yeah,
mixed with the music of Star Wars and the characters of Star Trek. So they definitely are looking at 2001 probably more than they are Star Wars.
Yes, yeah. The music was definitely influenced by Star Wars. I think Goldsmith has actually said that.
I think the music is the only thing that holds this movie together.
The music's really good.
It's great.
Yeah, it's really, really, really strong. I think he might have won an award for it, actually, Academy Award or something. But
I hope so.
I do want to stick to the start, just because to me, this, like, 90% of the conversation of this movie is the start, the first 40 minutes, and after that, it kind of gets away from us. So that section will be shorter.
I'll be completely honest with you. I watched this movie in, like, three chunks over the last 2 days.
Yep.
And I cannot tell you what happens in the middle of this movie.
I don't think there's anything to say, kind of.
Yeah, there's two events that happen, and then I don't know what happens in the surrounding time. And this movie feels like it takes forever to watch.
And so before we sound too negative, you had texted me the other night just saying that your thoughts about it were that there's a lot of stuff that you like in this movie, but you'd have a hard time recommending it to anybody. Do you want to just explain what you mean by that before we go on?
Well, I kind of hit on a bunch of it. Like, I think it's – one of the things I was doing while I was watching this is I actually started writing two lists, because I was trying to figure out what this movie was and why it is the way it is. And so I wrote down a list of why it works and why it doesn't work. And for me, why I think it works is it's got the original crew, very recognizable. It has that instant recognition that you get from seeing those characters. And you're seeing them in a way you haven't seen them before. The budget is much bigger. It's a much larger scope than anything the show's ever done. It's very ambitious. The music is amazing. The art direction is awesome. And it's really fucking weird.
Yeah.
Like, it's real weird.
Yep.
It's like, I don't know how else to describe it other than, like, it's like if Star Trek decided to just do a movie that was just 2001 A Space Odyssey but with Klingons in it or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know what I think it is? I mean, when I was watching it and I was just thinking that it's not like this is totally off the beaten path of what a Star Trek story
is. No, it's really not. Yeah.
So it's almost like they took the television aspect, which is super dialogue heavy, right? And they took the idea of a script like that and they just stuck it into a thematic experience where you don't need to talk as much because everything's more visual.
Yeah.
And what you end up with is this sort of boring, meandering, we're going to meet God story.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't feel wrong because it does feel like a Star Trek experience, but it feels wrong in the sense that the characters should be interacting with each other more than they actually are here.
Yeah, it's weird because I was watching it, I was thinking, you know, this feels like, I wouldn't be surprised if this was more true to what Roddenberry was thinking, just because it feels more like a hard sci-fi movie.
Yes, it does.
Like, imagine if you didn't know who these characters were. This would feel much more like a weird 70s, like, hard sci-fi, like Solaris or something like that.
If it came out without the Star Trek characters, I might actually think that I'm not understanding the movie.
That's fair, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'd be like, this movie must be so fucking deep because nothing is happening in it. I must just not be understanding what is going on.
Yeah. And, you know, to follow it up, the reason that on my list of why it doesn't work for me is I think the pace is excruciating. Especially after you get through the – it's flying around the Enterprise, if that was like a showcase moment that was not in line with the rest of the movie – it would be much I think it would – let's. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that scene where they slowly fly around the outside of the Enterprise is indicative of the rest of the movie.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, it's the entire movie is that pace, for better or worse.
Yeah.
The Trinity relationship just isn't there at all. I wrote down it's too hard sci-fi.
The Trinity, you mean McCoy, Spock, and
yes.
Kirk. Okay.
It's too hard sci-fi without any of the charm of the series.
Yeah.
The plot is not particularly riveting. Like, there's the concept in and of itself is kind of cool, you know, but it's just there's nothing there. And I think the biggest problem is there are no relatable stakes other than the destruction of the Earth, which we don't even see.
Right.
We have no connection to that. And there are no character, you know, even though they have these. So, we've probably talked about this too, but the problem when you get into these large scale, especially cosmic catastrophe things, is it's very hard to be relatable to anything.
Right.
And one of the things they did really well in the new Guardians of the Galaxy movie is you've got giant, massive universe scale stakes going on here, but the actual story being told is very small. And because your characters are going through a certain trials and certain arcs that make you invested in what's happening, even though you can't really wrap your mind around, oh, well, this guy's actually a planet and he's, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem here because they've got the big stuff. They've got the overarching ideas. They've got the really heady shit, which can be kind of fun, you know, if you're trying to fall asleep like I am. but there's nothing grounding you to what's happening. There's no reason for me to care about this movie.
Right.
I think
there's
something, I can't remember what we were watching. I can't remember if it was a movie or if it was another episode of the show. But I said it would make a really good it would be really good to cut it up and use it under, like, you know, one of those like new synth tracks that people are doing now.
Oh, sure.
A pre-made kind of found footage music video. This movie would be fantastic for that.
Yes.
Because there's so much weird imagery that you can kind of just cut together in really interesting ways and just kind of lay a cool, you know, whatever your cool synth track is on top of it. That would be really awesome. but, like, as a two-hour movie, this movie apparently made, like, a shitload of money.
Well, I guess that's up in the air. I mean, it made money. It didn't make enough for them to be enthusiastic about a sequel, so they cut the budget of the sequel.
Which is going to be interesting when we talk about that going forward, because, not to go too far, but it doesn't feel like they cut the budget on two. And then on three, apparently they had more money, but it looks like garbage.
Right. Right. I think it's the budget's being blown in weird ways. Like, a lot of the special effects in the motion picture cost a huge amount of the portion of the budget. But
oh, I can imagine.
It's really just like it's not – the budgets are not being spent in ways that you'd expect them to be spent.
Well, I mean, you know, the 90% of this movie takes place in the bridge.
Yes. Yeah.
There's like no – there's you get 90% of it on the bridge, like maybe – two scenes in the transporter room, which we haven't even talked about, the transporter room scene.
Yeah,
which, then there's like that gathering room where they have their conference there, and then which also doubles as like a game room.
Yes.
With some shitty ass games in it.
It's the vibe of this one is so 70s. Everyone feels like they should be just swinging in their spare time. You know what I mean? Like everyone,
especially Dr. McCoy, who for some reason is the only one who gets like a zip down and like a big collar. Like he just came. He shows up wearing like a big gold chain.
Yeah, he's got a huge gold chain and a beard. He looks like he's coming off a Coke bender. And he just got called back into action by Kirk, and he's pissed off about it. Let's talk about the we'll bring it back to that. Let's talk about the characters here.
Yeah.
Kirk, right? Is Kirk the hero of this story at all?
I mean, he's the hero in the way that he solves the problem.
Okay.
But, I mean, I don't know. I don't really know if there's... I mean, that's another thing that they don't give you at all, because they set up this tension between Kirk and Decker, but then they basically just wrap that up after. So after they go through the wormhole, which is another sequence that is just way too fucking long.
Yes, it's very, very long. And it's only done to give the situation where Decker can override Kirk's order.
Yeah, it's basically the equivalent. It's basically the equivalent of of a scene where your dad's driving, but he shouldn't be driving your car, and then he kind of veers off the highway onto the rumble strip.
Right.
And imagine like driving on the rumble strip for like 25 minutes, right. And then you just write the car, and then you're like, "Dad, you gotta trust me. I know this car better than you do." And he's like, "Okay, son.
Right.
we're cool, right?" And like that's the whole thing. I mean, it's a nice concept. Because, like I said, I like the idea that Kirk is, you know, doesn't know the ship anymore, and he's kind of
out of touch with everything.
Yeah, but then after they have that scene with after the wormhole bit with Decker and Kirk, where he's like, "Hey, don't do that," and then Decker's like, "I got to do that," and Kirk's like, "Okay, fine,
right."
That's it. That's kind of it.
That wraps up the story, and at that point, it turns into the Decker and Aaliyah thing, and Kirk.
But even
honestly
that,
sits in the background for the rest of the movie, not doing anything.
But even the Decker and Aaliyah thing, they don't give you any of that either.
No, they don't.
They give you one scene where she shows up, and they first of all they cut to Chekhov, and he looks like he's got the biggest boner in his pants. But then, like, you get this thing, you get one scene of them talking about how they used to kind of be a thing, like Proto, Riker, and Troy.
Yes.
And then they don't really do anything with it. Even after she gets taken by a giant laser probe, Decker doesn't even react to it.
No. I mean, what's funny about her, right, is that I think she might have, like, two lines before she's killed.
Yeah.
In this movie. And so there's no emotional attachment to her whatsoever. And I do remember watching this movie for the first time a long time ago. And I didn't realize until like the end of the movie that she was replaced by a robot, because I think I just zoned out for that whole series. So it was totally shocking to me that had happened. But the character has no... There's no reason for these characters to be in the movie outside of the fact that I feel like the Phase 2 writers were so lazy that they didn't want to take the characters out of the script at this point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a nice... The Decker character is a nice character to have in there.
Against
Kirk.
Yes.
But this relationship that, like, the entire climax of the movie hinges on is non-existent.
Right.
Like, you can make the case that having Decker sacrifice himself at the end the way he does could have been a nice way to cap off all of these storylines, because it would allow him to reunite with, you know, his lost love, Aaliyah, as well as prove something to Kirk about, you know, I don't know, something. but you don't, they don't earn any of that stuff. So it's just him, you know... getting a laser blasted up his ass.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that the ending is actually, you know, they save the day, but it's really like almost like worst case outcome for everybody outside of saving the Earth, because I'm not sure Kirk learns anything, because he's like, well, now I'm back in command of the Enterprise, so fuck that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
And Decker is dead and
missing,
right? Yeah, they changed that. So Decker and Aaliyah are missing. And Decker's sacrifice doesn't mean anything to me at the very end.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's no reason for you to care about the fact that he does that.
Right.
Like, and, you know, like you said, Kirk doesn't learn anything from it.
Right.
which is fundamentally the place where he should be learning something.
Right. That's the moment where all the plots should come together, and Kirk's sacrifice, you know, or the sacrifice inspires Kirk to go on with Starfleet, although that doesn't make sense, because the only thing he wants to do throughout the entire movie is be back in command of the Enterprise.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, Kirk's weird like that. I mean, McCoy is in this movie, but he doesn't really do anything.
He does absolutely nothing.
He acts like McCoy. He acts the most like the character that I'd expect out of everybody, but he doesn't do anything. He doesn't accomplish anything whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah. You know, even at the end, he goes down to Voyager because that's what they do in the show. He goes with them.
He goes with them.
Because he's the third billed name.
Right.
You know, there's no reason for him to be there, and he doesn't do anything, and he just kind of makes a quip about something after it's over. Like, and there's no... Yeah, I don't know.
And that leaves us with Spock. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on Spock in this movie? I understand that Kolinar is supposed to have done this to him. The movie sells his distant coldness as if Kirk had sex with his mother or something. Like there's this awkward tension between him and everybody that doesn't feel right. And I think if I was watching this back when it aired in 79, I would have been upset, being like, why aren't the characters friendly with each other? Like, so many TOS episodes mentioning Spock's his friend.
They have to find out that their moms have the same name.
That's right. Yeah. It would only take 50 years after it aired to get that in place.
Yeah, the Spock stuff is, I liked it at first because I, you know, like I was saying before, I liked having having things not just all be hunky dory when he shows back up and there has to be some work there. But there's like this weird thing where they suspect Spock of being there for personal reasons that is going to cause him to like undermine the mission or something, which doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't understand where that comes from,
right?
Or why they think he's going to do that, or why? And then like, so I guess that's supposed to play into when he takes the spacesuit out and goes 2001-ing,
yes,
through the butthole there.
Yep.
That like you're supposed to. Like Kirk gets all worried that he's going to do something. It's this tension that they're leaning on that doesn't make any narrative sense.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It definitely feels like it's a bunch of scripts that have just been stuck together, and they went with like the middle act of one of them and the outer acts of the other.
Well, what's
two
funny?
Like
apparently, Nimoy and Shatner had script approval.
Yes, they were rewriting this until the day of shooting.
Yeah, which, sure.
I mean, if that actually makes more sense, because by the end of TOS, the actors were apparently at each other's throats all the time.
Yeah.
And if that tension is continuing into this movie, and that they're basically just doing this as a money thing, what's funny is that all the supporting cast always seem like they enjoyed the show more than the main three actors did.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, you know, you get a lot of like Koenig being very happy and Nichelle Nichols and everything talk about the good times, but everyone else seems very one-uppy, and we'll get into this when they start, when the actors actually start directing the movies.
Yeah.
But I think that that 40 minutes, that opening up until the wormhole scene, the movie is bizarre and interesting to me, and it's so dark, it's so angry, and it's so unlike the TV show.
I think this is a good time to mention how they set up the excuse to get Spock back into the science officer position is because there is another Vulcan who is supposed to be the science officer. They set up earlier that the transporter isn't working right, which is why the excuse they give to have Kirk and Scotty take the transport shuttle around the ship. But then later,
even though he beams into that ship.
But it's the Enterprise specifically whose transporter isn't working.
Right, yeah, but the Enterprise, the transporter is always, you can always beam from some transporter to anywhere, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I guess, well, maybe they haven't established that yet, I don't know. But after establishing that, they go to beam on the science officer, and they're beaming him and another guy up at the same time, and they get brundle-flied together.
Yes.
Because their patterns get crossed, and they get merged into some sort of, like, grotesque deformity that, to quote the guy on the other end, didn't live long, thankfully. And so they just... The first thing that happens after he gets back into the ship is the science officer gets brutally killed by a malfunction of this future technology that serves, like, that doesn't play into anything later. Like, there's no malfunction on the ship or anything.
It's not even
sort of, maybe,
it's not even Kirk's like the way to play that, right, is that you make it, it would be way too dark, but it has to be Kirk's fault, right? He has to be back, he has to be pushing himself into a situation that he's not prepared for.
Yeah.
And that's what causes someone to die. And he has his moment of reckoning, you know, it's like, can I do this? Like, I want to do this, but am I still able to do this? But he has, yeah, he has no impact on that transporter accident. He's just standing there. Yeah,
I think making that his fault would be too dark.
It would be too dark. But the transporter accident,
I know what you mean, though.
It ties into the gloom of the first 40 minutes is so weird. And that's why that transporter accident, while it's narratively doesn't make any sense, it feels like it fits the atmosphere, like the environment of what the movie's trying to do at that point.
Yeah, and the hilarious part is two scenes later, they beam McCoy to the ship. And McCoy, they make it a point to point out that McCoy is not happy about beaming because he doesn't like beaming.
No, he hates it.
And in this case, he's 100% right.
What'd you think of the transporter redesign? They make it seem like it's much more of a dangerous thing because the people are basically behind like blast doors when they beam them up.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's,
that's kind of cool. I mean, you know, I do like there being a little bit more weight to some of this technology, and it's not just, you know, magic, basically.
Right, yeah. What's funny about the transporter to me as I was doing the review, it's like it was the initial idea was that the ship would always land on the planets, but it was too expensive to do that, so they came up with a transporter. And it's one of those great things of sometimes the less expensive option just turns out to be the best thing possible.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like the transport – is there anything like – it's one of the top most iconic – aspects of the show, right? And it comes about as a budget saving mechanism where you're just like, yeah, whatever, just we'll just blink them down to the planet, they'll be down there,
yeah,
be fine.
Which is also ironic because it becomes a budget saving thing later when they just stop using it,
right?
They just start the show when they're already on the planet or vice versa.
Yeah. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about in the opening before we just sort of breeze through the rest of the movie, because there's not really much else to do with it? I mean, there's really not anything crazy that goes on in that early segment. We get very little of the other crewmen. You get very little of Sulu, who I think has more deleted scenes than he actually has scenes in the movie.
I guess the one thing that does stand out to me is it seemed like it was – this is something easy to point out now after, you know, 40 years or so, or almost 35 years of this movie and other movies that have come after it that have done similar stuff. It seems to be the first instance of the ship not being at full power, full capacity,
yes,
and just doing what it's doing because it's the only ship in the area.
Yeah, right.
Which, I don't know. I mean, I guess looking back, being the first movie, I understand that because you know you got to have your ship. You got to have stuff at a disadvantage. You have to have some sort of stakes or some sort of tension, etc. But I mean, at this point, after seeing so many other, like James Bond, he never just goes on a mission.
Right.
He's always going rogue. You just wish you would get to watch him go on a mission.
Right.
And it's the same thing here, where it's like I would have liked to see, I guess. This is unfair to me to say as a criticism of the movie for the reasons I just stated, but I would have liked to see the crew just going on a mission.
Right. I mean, does there need to be I guess there does, because I'm really interested in what the movie starts off by saying about this Kirk aspect, about them.
Yeah.
Like, it's basically them aging, and the movie does not continue with it. The later movies are going to continue with it, but this movie is not particularly interested in resolving it. So I think that they need the opening of Kirk pushing his way back in so the mission setup doesn't work. But I do agree that the constantly needing to raise the stakes of getting into the situation doesn't feel completely necessary all the time. Like, the situation itself should be the stakes that get raised, not the this is the only ship in the area and things have to go this way and that way to get everything in order for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a fine way to do things, but I think they do it a lot. The only thing, the other thing I'll say about the beginning is getting Spock on the ship is really clunky. I wish there was, I think that's another place they could have been a little bit more thematically or something thematically cohesive in what they were trying to do. Like, if
Do you mean the actual like physicality of him flying in on a ship, or the narrative way to bring him in?
Well, that's just another of the many, many scenes of space docking in this movie. There's so much docking in this movie. No, just like the plot mechanics of getting him there, because it's just sort of like he just kind of is there. He just kind of shows up.
Yes.
And he shows up for not to be the science officer, but then they're like, well, you're in luck. Our science officer is a puddle now, so right. We need a new science officer.
He was a Vulcan too, so we won't have to learn new names or anything like that.
But yeah, it's just, I don't know, like the motivation, I guess, for Spock to be on the ship is very lacking, and I think it could have been a little bit smoother way to get him onto the ship.
Yeah.
And at least tell us what he's trying to do.
So
I don't know.
I think that the movie at this point devolves into, it abandons all these plot threads that we've been talking about for the first 50 minutes of the podcast. Like none of these storylines are going to get resolved.
Yeah. The way that I was thinking about it is like, it's like there's all these things that are going on. Right. But at some point all the crew members were like, listen, I know you and I have our differences, but right now we have a job to do. And the guy's like, yeah, we should just like forget about this for now.
Yep.
And just see what's going on here, and then maybe when we're done, we can talk about this. But as of right now, we're cool. We're totally cool, and we're just going to do our job.
That's a very Star Trek-y way to go about things, I think. And at that point, we deal with V'ger and the end. I'm not particularly interested in talking about V'ger. We've talked about.
I just love that they. I can't remember. I think it might be the same year or possibly like a year before, but they Zardozzed it, which I loved.
Oh, well, yeah. What's the Zardoz thing? That's the Connery movie, isn't it?
Yeah. So the secret of Zardoz is that Zardoz is actually it generated out of this basically a sacred text,
right?
That whatever the people, you know, whatever. And it turns out that the sacred text is the Wizard of Oz, right. but some of the letters were scraped off of it, so they just read it as Zardoz.
Zardoz, yeah,
and you know, and ergo V'ger.
You know that this plot, one of the sort of critical names for this, like the critics would come up with, it's very much like the Spinal Tap. One review just said "shit sandwich" type.
Yeah.
It's called Star Trek The Motionless Picture. That's one of them. My favorite is Star Trek Where Nomad Has Gone Before, because I don't know if you're familiar with this. There's an episode of TOS in the second season called The Changeling, which is exactly this story.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's a probe launched from Earth called Nomad, who goes down to deep space and gets lost, and an alien machine planet finds it, develops it into like a super-powered intelligence gathering thing, and then sends it back to meet its creator. It spends the entire episode saying, bring me back to my creator.
Wow, that's a deep cut of a burn that guy or that person threw out there. I thought it was Nomad, like, just because it just wanders for 2 hours.
No, that's it's just the probe. So Roddenberry apparently loved this idea, right? He's done it multiple times. He refused to write the movie without that idea in it. What is this movie about? Like, is this some sort of, is this Roddenberry's take on God or something? If it is his take on God, what does he think God is? He's not even being satirical about it. If he's like an atheist who doesn't believe, he's not outside the idea that he's saying like God is essentially anything outside of your realm of comprehension. Mm-hmm. What's the point of that?
I could see it being a God analogy as in, you know, you could look at it from a atheistic standpoint of it being God ends up being something that you created.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I think it's, he seemed to never be interested in just the standard sci-fi plot, the standard like action adventure sci-fi plot.
Yeah.
And the other kind of stock sci-fi plot is the massive intelligence sci-fi plot.
Yeah.
The cosmic godlike creature.
Well, Roddenberry's funny because he's not interested in the... He clearly didn't want to do the sort of like action-y adventure movie here.
Right.
But his idea isn't deep enough or like intellectually interesting enough to be the other side where it's like more of a hard sci-fi sort of allegory story.
Right, yeah.
So it's in this weird middle area where it's not really an action movie and it's not really about anything. And you end up just going like, well, yeah, they... Like, think of the conflict of V'ger. They fly for an hour and a half to get to Voyager. They discover what it is, and then they immediately solve the problem about it. There's no conflict going on.
Yeah, I mean, and that's... I think any analogy that they'd try to be making or any metaphor they would try to be making, if there is one at all, loses any potency because nobody learns anything.
Right.
None of the characters change except Spock. But even that's like tangential.
Right.
You know, he just is like, man, I stuck my finger in that electrical socket and I just want to tell you I love you.
Yeah.
You know, he's not the center of the story.
Right.
And his plot line is not strong enough to validate that sort of allegorical reading of it.
Well, I feel like his plot line is only there to allow the ending to happen that they have, where it's supposed to be love is what conquers everything. You know, it's a Voyager only wants to find the love of its creator and merge with it. And outside of that, there's no reason for Spock to feel this outcome of feeling love and everything. Like, he should just be overwhelmed by the fact that apparently V'ger knows everything. That's the other god allegory, is that V'ger has become conscious because it knows everything at this point. That doesn't amount to anything. It doesn't...
I think that's a good way to sum up everything in this movie, is it doesn't amount to anything.
Right.
It's like everything that happens is largely inconsequential.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, even the Spock thing, there is a little bit of interesting stuff there, because one of the things he does say is that he tapped into it and it was a being of pure logic, and he realized that, you know, it was lacking the ability for human touch or whatever, or, you know, and that kind of thing is kind of interesting. But again, his plot line is not clean enough and not prominent enough for that to be really a big revelation.
Yep.
And he doesn't really change that much. Like, there's, I think that right before that, he like laughs.
Yes, he smiles and laughs.
But it's off screen, so you don't even get. I noticed that like they're on Kirk, and then you hear, and then you know they have Kirk walk over to him, and he's still kind of just got the Spock face on, and he says all the stuff about the touch and the probe.
Yes,
and it's like, so you are. You set up this character to be in search of pure logic, and he's even colder than he was before. And the one moment that you give him to break that, and you don't even put it on camera?
Yeah, yep. Yeah, it's...
I don't know.
The Spock thing, I agree with that. Like, the emotional breakthrough is supposed to... If it's supposed to be an important segue because he's gone through Kolinar or whatever it is, they never tell you any of that. Like, I'm inclined to even think that I'm wrong about the Kolinar thing is the reason why he's cold, because it's never stated. And it feels, if it's supposed to be that way, it feels like the movie doesn't treat that ceremony as important enough to warrant it being of something that'll have an impact for the rest of the movie. So Spock's whole arc feels to me like it's just a bunch of disconnected scenes that don't add up to anything, because I can't track the central spine of the story.
Now, if someone out there who knows better than I or we do wants to do this for us, I know that there's a theatrical a director's cut out there that, I don't know, people claim it plays differently depending on the cut.
The Zeist cut of Star Trek.
Yeah, the Zeist cut. If they want to tell us if any of this stuff is different or gets cleared up in the director's cut, that would be great.
Yes.
But I'm not going to watch it again.
No.
I mean, to be fair, let me rephrase that. I will watch this movie again. I enjoy this movie, not in like a movie-going experience, but just like as a washing over me kind of experience. I would definitely put this movie on in the background while I'm working. I would definitely put it on if I was trying to sleep. But I would never sit down with someone and say, hey, let's take 2 hours out of our day to watch Star Trek the Motion Picture. So
right.
if someone else wants to do that, that would be great.
I'd appreciate
they
it.
They may already know this. I don't know.
No, I would love to know the difference between what he could have cleaned up. I know that he cut down scenes. I think it's a shorter movie.
Yeah, and I
would love to know how that's actually changed. I think we're pretty much done with this one. There's nothing about the ending. The ending ties into the whole, I'm not really sure what this is about, and then Kirk just wins back the Enterprise, and we all go on our merry way.
I have to say, that's the Spock butthole sequence is...
Your favorite?
Yeah, it really is. It's really cool. Like, it's... You know, I love it when these movies get weird. You know, like I've said a million times on TNG, my favorite episodes are the ones where they get weird. And they get weird in this movie.
Yes.
That whole sequence is... It's very reminiscent of 2001, but it's like the whatever they're doing, I couldn't even figure out how they were doing a lot of it, like effects-wise.
Right, yeah.
Because it wasn't computers, but it was probably a cross between some models and optics and stuff. But it's really cool looking, and it's really weird, and it would make a great screensaver.
Yeah, I think my favorite scene is actually the Enterprise flyby, just because...
Yeah, no, that's great too. Yeah. It's really cool.
I think that a good way to wrap it up is, like, it is a very conflicting movie, and it ties into what you texted me before about you wouldn't recommend... Like, I could never tell anyone that they should watch this movie. Like, there's...
If we were talking about Star Trek movies and someone was like, oh, I've never seen the first one, I would not be the one to be like, oh, you got to see the
right,
first one.
Right. Yeah, it sets the stage for everything. It feels so detached from everything. And but there's stuff in it that I feel they could have made a movie out of. Like, I love the whole Kirk angle to it. I even like the V'ger plot, if they had turned that into something. I love the scope of it and all the stuff. And like, I like the way it looks, and I like the way that they changed how the ship looks. I think they went a little too far in some ways, but if they had tied it into feeling a little bit more like the series while keeping the sort of more grown-up theme of aging and losing your way, I think it could have been something. I don't know how you tie that into V'ger at all. I don't think it very easily works its way into that narrative, but, you know, get rid of Decker. Or keep Decker. Get rid of Ilea because she's useless.
I don't necessarily think you need to do that. Because I think there is still room there for their plot to be a thing.
Okay.
What I will say is almost unsavable is when she gets turned into that probe. Holy
right.
shit! That 40 minutes of the movie is just bad. Like the scene where Decker's trying to show her how to play the game in the game room, and McCoy and Kirk are watching it from another room.
Yep.
And, like, she doesn't touch the thing, and Kirk reacts as though, like, ah, damn it, we almost had her. It's like, what is going on? What is they trying? And then my favorite part of the movie. When they're like, we have to figure out some other way to help her reconnect. Hard cut to her looking in the mirror wearing this ridiculous headpiece. And then someone off screen, I think it's Major Barrett or something.
It is, yeah, it's Nurse Chapel.
You used to love this headband.
It's the headband she was wearing when she met Decker, I guess. Her most emotional headband.
That whole section is just like, holy shit. You couldn't have done this stuff in like 10 minutes tops and just moved it along to the end of the movie.
Right. It's just that storyline. I feel no chemistry between the two of them, mostly because they have one scene where they're allowed to do anything with each other.
She's also not a great actress.
No, she's not.
Stephen Collins is pretty good, though.
Yeah, he's good. I have no problem with him.
Which I hate to say, given his, you know, what he is in real life. But.
But he's you know, and he's supposed to be the son of Commodore Decker from the Doomsday Machine.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
That's that tie-in right there for him. But and I guess we have to mention one important thing, which kind of ties in with the Discovery trailer we just talked about. What do you think of the new Klingons?
Oh, yeah, the werewolf Klingons.
Yes.
I find it interesting. The Klingons, to me, are just generally an interesting evolution to watch across these movies because each iteration kind of like sets a little bit more of it in stone for the next one.
Yes.
So you've got the bumps on the head, but they're all basically the same. and their uniforms are a little bit more traditional.
TNG Klingons.
Yeah, TNG Klingons. And you've got, excuse me, I didn't watch any episodes of TOS that had Klingons, so I don't know if they did this in
Tribbles,
the show. But
Tribbles.
Oh, I mean like with ships and stuff.
Oh, with ships, sure.
But the Klingon bridge has that like hot red light.
Yeah.
Which red lighting seems to be just an indicator of Klingons for the rest of the series.
Yes, yeah. I don't think there's actually a shot of a interior of a Klingon ship on TOS.
There you go, that too.
Yeah, there's the Romulans. I agree that it's weird. It's weird that they change them so much. And
yeah, that's another place where I can see, I mean, what you're saying about...
Like, imagine if you into this after... would you spend... If you were a fan of the show and you came in 79 and you were watching that, would you just lean over the person next to you and go, are those Klingons? Like, what's happening? Is this... Are we...
Oh, no, I 100% would do that, yeah.
Yeah, it's weird that they changed them so much. I think that the design is better than what it was. But, yeah, it's interesting... A, to even include them because they're so inconsequential to it. They have no plot to the story. You could have just had it done to a Federation ship, right?
Yeah, I think it's just...
you want to see the Klingons attack it, basically? Is that the difference?
Yeah, I think it's just kind of fan service-y.
Yeah.
Much like their appearance in Star Trek Into Darkness, they don't really serve a purpose other than to just be like, oh, hey, Klingons cool.
Right. Yeah, we've heard of them. Yeah, I think that's it. We're just going to wrap up without playing another audio clip as we normally do, but it's a weird movie.
It really is.
It's a very 70s kind of movie, and like not in a particularly good way. It just has all the sort of 70s tropes piled onto a Star Trek episode, and
it really feels like a low budget 70s sci-fi movie that's like just itching to burst through the big budget top of it. Like there's so many things where it's like it's like you're like two clicks away from Logan's Run right now.
Right. we normally rate the episodes on a scale of 1 to 5. I think we'll do that for the movies as well. I don't see a reason not to.
I think we should rate the movies on a scale from 1 to First Contact.
They can all occupy one space. I think I probably will do it. I'll do a rating of the movies afterwards, or a ranking of them, but we'll stick the 1 to 5. I'm gonna give the motion picture a 2, I think. But the motion picture, I think, is the hardest movie out of all of them to rate properly.
I think you're right, yeah. And one of the other things that's interesting about this, and all of these movies moving forward, is for a... franchise of films featuring all of the same characters and you know some fairly iconic imagery. Every one of these movies more or less looks different than the last one.
Yeah.
Like by the time Wrath of Khan looks nothing like this movie. And Search for Spock looks different because you're in different locations. 4 is way different because obviously you're on Earth.
Yep.
5 is a little bit more, I guess 5 and 6 are a little bit more kind of streamlined, but they go through a lot of kind of changes and growing pains to find the wheelhouse for this series as a movie franchise.
Yeah. And go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that the TOS movies are unique is because the movies all feel different, and it feels like they're sort of exploring a different visual look and different theme with all of them. Mm-hmm. The TNG movies we're going to see suffer because the TNG movies all kind of feel like episodes turned into movies in a way. Like,
yeah,
there's not enough space between the end of the series and the movies to really change things up, and the feeling of each of them are not different enough. They all kind of feel the same, and it's just the plot is different, and The reason I appreciate the motion picture is because even though I don't think it really works, they did something completely different with the source material in this movie. And I at least have some respect and trying.
It's almost like they adapted it like you would adapt a novel.
Right, yeah.
You know, where it's like you've got pieces of it. If you were familiar with the novel, you'd be familiar with a bunch of it, but there'd be enough in there for you to be like, oh, that's weird. It's weird that they changed that.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you gonna rate this one?
Oh, that's tough. It's hard for me to go higher than a 2.
Yeah.
Cause it's like
we listed a lot of problems.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, it's this weird thing where I don't particularly think it's a good movie, but there's something kind of oddly engaging about it.
Yeah.
And like it's really hard for me to quantify. Like even at the end when I was trying to summarize my notes, the first thing I wrote was I don't know. I think ultimately anything that's kind of plot interesting is just, or the themes gets so smothered by the visual effects and stuff. And
yeah. Yep.
You know, it's very heady, but not in a way that makes you think.
Yeah. I would hesitate to even say it's almost an attempt to be heady or something.
Yeah.
Like there's really nothing there in my opinion. It's just kind of pretending to have something to say. And
yeah.
It's almost like it's the 70s style. It feels like it's the 70s style of filmmaking without a point to it, where you could really like sort of tack on like, this is the theme and this is what went on and everything like that. It's a very odd movie. We'll wrap it up with, what do you think the Rotten Tomatoes score is for this movie?
Ooh, Rotten Tomatoes. Let's see. It's been 30 years. I'm going to say,
let's go with the critic first, and then I'll ask you for the audience score.
Okay. Critics, I'm going to say 65.
It's 44 for the critics.
Ooh, damn. Really? And, that low?
Yeah. What do you think for the audience?
Audience is like 79.
No, it's actually 42, which is shocking.
Really?
That's more surprising than the critical reaction.
Wow.
To it,
yeah. Usually the audience for these movies, that like any movie that's been around longer than 10 years, it's like a 7-year high.
100%. I know, especially something like Star Trek. You'd think you'd just get people. It's like Yelp reviews. You're only going to get the positive or the negative, I guess. Yeah, interesting. 44% for the critics, 42% for the audience. That feels about right, I think. You know, all things considered, I think you've got every good point, you've got two sort of weird or bad points, so you're going to knock it down to that kind of a score. Anyway, I think that's it. Guys, thank you very much for listening to the Motion Picture Podcast. We're well on our way to getting through all the Star Trek movies. Give myself a good stretch right there. Clay, thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this since we started 3 years ago.
It's been nice. It's been refreshing to go into the movies. Hopefully we don't get burnt out by how many we have to go through, but it's nice to break up the tone every once in a while with what they are.
Yeah. For me anyway, I get more burnt out by the show.
Yeah.
Because so much of it is so similar.
Yep.
That it's kind of, I mean, how many times can you talk about the same stuff, sort of?
Yep.
And they all tend to run together. I mean, anybody who listens to the show knows that I have no recollection of anything that I've watched. But the movies are different enough and engaging in different ways and good for different reasons and bad for different reasons that I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Like, you know, like I've said, the movies are the original crew to me, not the show.
Right.
So
yeah.
I'm going to enjoy this, I think.
Yeah. And, guys, if you're on YouTube watching this and liking the comments, appreciate it. If you're on iTunes or any of the other podcatchers and you listen to the show, you could rate us there. We'd appreciate it. Facebook.com/ThePenske Podcast. And you can go to Patreon.com/ThePenske File, because I just changed that. So it's Patreon.com/ThePenske File. And that's a way to support all the shows that we do, including Star Trek, The Prisoner, his upcoming stuff coming out, all that stuff. If you like any of those things, you can go to patreon.com/ThePenske File, give a couple dollars, you get extra content, all that stuff. It's greatly appreciated. I think that's it. We're done with the motion picture. It was everything.
I can't guarantee that my comments for Wrath of Khan and then later First Contact aren't going to just be me like playing an extended guitar solo. But I will try to be as objective as possible.
Khan will be good. And First Contact, yeah, we'll see how it... I'm interested to see how it feels to be getting back to the TNG crew at this point. That's something I actually think about as I'm watching these movies. I'll be like, what will happen when we get to back to the actual TNG crew?
I will say I recently watched Insurrection.
Yep.
Having watched it maybe once when it came out in video 20 years ago. Oh, geez, it's been that long? Yeah.
Yes, it has. Yep.
And being removed enough. We had been doing Next Generation, the podcast, so I was more familiar with the show. I had that more fresh than I did at the time. Not as bad as I remember it being.
No.
It's definitely like a long episode, and it's not a bad movie. It's not obviously what I think people wanted, especially after First Contact, but it's not bad.
I feel, and we'll get into it, I feel like all the TNG movies are slightly underrated. Like, maybe not underrated, but they're a little bit more hated on than I think they deserve. Not to say that they're great movies or anything like that, but the amount of flack that Nemesis gets kind of annoys me, even though I think Nemesis is not particularly a good movie, and Insurrection's kind of the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, guys, go to all the sites that I mentioned. Check us out there. Otherwise, subscribe on YouTube, subscribe on iTunes. We're going to be keeping on with the Star Trek movies. 2 months of this, so you can check it out. Check out all the other series, all the other shows, everything like that. Clay, thank you again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And we will be back in a week with The Wrath of Khan. See you then.